Good evening and welcome to a History Show special on some of the nastiest presidential elections in the 250-odd year history of the USA. It was originally a song about a Scottish boat, but since the early 19th century, Hail to the Chief has rather incongruously become the personal anthem of the President of the United States. In order for the Chief to be entitled to this musical greeting, he, or possibly she, will probably have endured a long, rigorous and often vituperative election campaign. In case you thought American presidential elections only began to get really nasty in 2016, nothing could be further from the truth. Tonight, we're going to look at a cross-section of some of the more malevolent contests, starting with the race between Democratic candidate Grover Cleveland and Republican James G. Blaine in 1884. Professor Glenn Genzel lectures in American history at San Jose State University.
Grover Cleveland was the governor of New York and had a reputation as an honest reformer. He was known as Grover the Good. That was his nickname. And he'd made a name for himself in New York politics by taking on the Tammany Hall machine that was notoriously corrupt and infamous for that throughout the nation. So as the mayor of Buffalo first and then governor, he had built a reputation as a reformer in the Democratic Party, which was the minority party throughout the so-called Gilded Age in the post-Civil War decades in American politics when Republicans dominated national politics.
The Republican candidate then, James G. Blaine, he actually had to unseat an incumbent president, which is something that doesn't happen very often.
Yes, Chester Alan Arthur had become president by assassination, as has happened more than a few times in American history. So the assassination of James Garfield had elevated a political hack named Chet Arthur into the presidency. And he was so shamed by it that he actually devoted a lot of his administration to civil service reform. But no one in the party thought that he would be a suitable candidate to carry the banner into the general election. So after much infighting among the different factions of the Gilded Age Republicans, they settled on Senator James G. Blaine of Maine, Blaine of Maine. And he was a leader in the party and in the Senate and was very well known throughout the nation, but not entirely in a good way.
Why was that?
He was dogged by scandal. James Blaine was notorious as a tool of the railroad lobbies and had been exposed taking bribes from railroad companies. The so-called Mulligan letters were publicly available by the 1884 election, in which some years earlier, Blaine had openly discussed taking payments from railroad lobbyists and railroad executives in exchange for government favors that he could arrange as a very powerful and influential senator. And most damningly, he had inscribed at the bottom of some of these letters the words, "burn this letter," which, you know, was rather self-incriminating when those letters, unburnt, resurfaced later. So the Democratic mobs enjoyed campaigning in 1884, taunting their Republican foes, "burn this letter, burn this letter," to remind everyone of the Mulligan letters and the Blaine scandals.
But the Republicans managed to dig up some pretty serious dirt on Cleveland as well, didn't they?
They sure did. It turned out that Grover the Good was perhaps not so good in all respects, because the Republicans were able to produce a sworn affidavit from a woman named Maria Halpin back in Buffalo, who claimed to have given birth to Grover Cleveland's illegitimate son. And when confronted with the evidence, Cleveland did not deny it. He admitted that it was true, that he had fathered an illegitimate child by a prostitute in Buffalo. Well, Cleveland was a bachelor at the time, and he openly admitted the details where he and several of his buddies were sharing her services and supporting her. And when the child was born, he believed it was not entirely clear that he was the father, but because he was the one bachelor in the group, he agreed to step up, take responsibility, and pay for the child's education and support. So he had been doing that, but he was reluctant to admit that the child was definitely his. And he was just willing to take the responsibility. And even though the Republicans had a field day with this scandal, I mean, these days, presidential sex scandals are the biggest, most salacious sensation of every campaign season. But in his day, it was sort of commonplace to expect that upper-class men would consort with prostitutes on the side. It was not exactly honorable, but it was not unknown. So Cleveland was able to benefit from that. And a wave among at least Democratic voters of sympathy for his honesty in owning up to his responsibility and paying for the upkeep of the child and the mother. Still, Republican mobs taunted the Cleveland mobs throughout the nation in 1884 during that election with the chant, "Ma, Ma, where's my pa? Ma, Ma, where's my pa?" Trying to, you know, evoke the pathetic couple back in Buffalo.
So the two main slogans of the 84 election were "Burn, burn, burn this letter," and "Ma, Ma, where's my pa?" But I think the Democrats had a ready-made riposte to "Ma, Ma, where's my pa?" after one of the tightest elections ever.
Yes. After Cleveland won the election, when Republicans were taunting "Ma, Ma, where's my pa?" the Democrats taunted back, "Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." And, you know, that made for a good back and forth, like football cheers, really. It was good practice for that. But in the end, the election was probably decided not by either scandal, but rather by something else that happened during the election. That was a different scandal no one had anticipated. Blaine, the Republican candidate, showed up at a rally in New York where a Presbyterian minister named Samuel Burchard was giving a typically anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic speech that was common coinage in the Republican Party. That was the way they unified their base in that day. They were the party of nativists, of anti-immigrants, and Protestant, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Americans in the North. So the Reverend Burchard gave a speech attacking the Democrats as what he called the party of, quote, "rum, Romanism, and rebellion," unquote. So conveniently tying together the drinking patterns of immigrants, their religious beliefs, and the formerly Confederate supporters of the Democratic Party in the South. And, you know, that was red meat to Republican audiences, but it was enough to infuriate the heavily Irish Catholic electorate of New York City and other northern working class districts, so that the crucial swing state of New York, Grover Cleveland's home state, went Democratic that year. And combined with the solid South that was always Democratic, you know, for generations after the Civil War, when the Republicans were identified with Abraham Lincoln and the, you know, the hated Yankee armies that pillaged their part of the country, the solid South plus New York was enough to deliver a victory to Grover Cleveland, who was the only Democrat elected president between 1856 and 1912. So in a 56-year period, Cleveland stood alone. Otherwise, it was all Republicans. And Cleveland was elected twice, as well as defeated once. But that's another story.
Our gallant Cleveland is the man. Democrats, good Democrats, to whip the whole Blaine Logan clan. Democrats, good Democrats, he is a statesman brave and true. He'll get the gray, he'll get the blue, he's just the man for me and you. Democrats, good Democrats.
In 1896, Grover Cleveland had become the first president to serve two non-consecutive terms after losing the 1888 election to the Republican Benjamin Harrison and making a successful White House bid in 1892. Because the 22nd Amendment to the US Constitution, limiting presidents to two terms, was not ratified until 1951, Cleveland had the right to depart from an abiding American political tradition and stand for re-election. But, as Glenn Genzel points out, that was not on the cards.
Grover Cleveland was in office for his second term in 1893 when the nation was hit by what at that time was the most cataclysmic of the cyclical downturns to which capitalism is prone. The worst would come later in 1929, but in 1893, that was the worst yet. Millions were thrown out of work, banks closed, railroads and businesses closed, the ranks of homeless in the streets multiplied, and, you know, starvation roamed the land. So the nation was mired in what at that time was called the Great Depression of the 1890s, going into the 1896 election. So Cleveland and the Democrats thought that he was not the best standard bearer for the party in light of the collapse of the nation's economy at the time and Cleveland's own health. He was suffering from mouth cancer and had had half of his jaw removed and replaced with a rubber prosthesis so that he could still give speeches. But he didn't want to run for president again.
The Democratic Party nominee, therefore, was somebody who was very much on the radical end of the party, wasn't he?
Yes, this is what makes the 1896 election fascinating, because the previous Gilded Age elections had turned on the issues of religion and immigration, you know, nativists versus immigrants and Protestants versus Catholics and the prohibitionists versus those who approved of the right to drink. These were the big issues, as well as old Civil War memories before 1896. But in that year, the Democrats nominated William Jennings Bryan, a congressman from Nebraska, who injected the new issues raised by the Industrial Revolution into presidential politics that previous candidates had ignored. So these issues had been raised by the People's Party, it was called, a third party movement that tried to get the Republicans and Democrats to get away from the old issues and talk about the problems of workers in factories or farmers whose incomes were falling and who were severely crushed by debt, to talk about the problems of the Industrial Revolution, of monopolies and the exploitation of labor, and to stop talking about religion and ethnicity, immigration and civil war issues. So the populace had been gaining votes, mostly at the expense of the Democrats, and that's why the Democrats decided to go with William Jennings Bryan in 1896, because he was a candidate who embraced populist issues but remained in the Democratic Party.
And the Republican nominee was a rather more conventional candidate.
The Republican nominee in 1896 was William McKinley of Ohio, and he was a hardcore protectionist, identified with the sky-high McKinley tariff that he had shepherded through Congress and had made a name for himself on that issue. So while the Democrats were coalescing around the populist issue of what they called free silver, meaning a currency that would be based on silver as well as gold in order to reinflate the economy and help farmers and perhaps workers too, McKinley stood solidly in defense of the gold standard without silver. And that was the position preferred by banks and big corporations, and especially those involved in international trade, even though the price for farmers was unbearable. And a little inflation was just what farmers needed. But the gold standard was the rock bottom unifying issue, along with a high tariff, for the Republican Party. And they stood on that platform against Bryan and the free silver issue.
The two campaigns were very, very different in style, weren't they?
Yes. Bryan was the youngest presidential candidate up to that time. I think he was only 36 years old. And he traveled the nation on railroads using, you know, the new railroad network, and gave speeches all over the country. And he was a legendary orator in the old days before amplifiers and microphones, you know. He had leather lungs and a silver tongue, they used to say. The silver tongue boy orator of the Platte River, that was his nickname. And he had a booming voice that could be heard in the last row at the county fairs and the giant halls that he addressed, the tents, you know, put up all over the country. So Bryan is considered the first sort of national barnstorming campaign in 1896. But William McKinley, the Republican nominee, preferred to play it safe by running what his managers called a front porch campaign. So he stayed at home at his house in Ohio and entertained a series of delegations that would come to visit him. And each one would represent some vital interest group or some region of the country or some ethnic or religious group. And he would meet with them and give a noble, carefully composed speech for the newspapers to publish. And in that way, he used media and manipulation of media to try to get his message out as a calm and in charge kind of candidate who was not out there on the hustings begging for a job like he portrayed Bryan. Instead, McKinley was the noble servant of the people waiting for the job to come to him by staying at home. Now, it helped that McKinley's campaign was the most lavishly funded presidential campaign in American history up to that time. I mean, he outspent the Bryan campaign by something like 12 to 1. His campaign finance organizer, Mark Hanna, also of Ohio, was very successful at convincing big corporations, banks, and railroads that if they didn't help McKinley get elected, then disaster loomed. So that would become the trademark imagery and phraseology of Republicans running against Democrats from 1896 onward. They always warned that electing a Democrat would lead to economic ruin, such as had occurred under Cleveland after the Panic of 1893.
Now, the candidate may have adopted a front porch approach to the campaign, but his surrogates adopted an ad hominem campaign when it came to William Jennings Bryan, didn't they?
Well, because they had so much money at their disposal, the Republicans sent paid professional lecturers throughout the nation to give all kinds of damning, scurrilous, vicious attacks in speeches that sort of trailed Bryan wherever he went to counteract his influence wherever he went, you know, accusing him of being a religious fanatic because he was such a heartfelt, born-again Protestant Christian, and being a dangerous crackbrained lunatic in league with the populist farmers whose support he had. So the Republicans tried to portray him as, you know, typical of these farmers who'd perhaps been out in the sun too long and whose brains were affected by that and were not entirely sound on economic matters. And the most devastating line they took against Bryan was the warning to workers in particular that they would all lose their jobs if Bryan was elected. And indeed, employers of factories throughout the land cooperated with that strategy by putting up signs that said, if Bryan wins on Tuesday, don't come to work on Wednesday. This establishment will be closed. So that it was a kind of a threat of a capital strike that often lurks behind the Republican Party politics ever since 1896.
The popular vote was close enough, around 600,000 out of 13 million votes cast, and Bryan won almost as many states as McKinley, but the Electoral College result in 1896 was not close at all.
Yes, this was the first election that showed a pattern in the Electoral College that would stay in place for years afterwards. The Gilded Age pattern of swing states moving back and forth that helped Cleveland get elected was over. Now you had what Bryan called his Great Crescent, which was all of the West and all of the South going for the Democrats, two-thirds of the nation, if you looked at a map, you know, its surface area going for the Democrats. But that upper one-third, the Northeast and the upper Midwest around the Great Lakes, was solidly Republican for McKinley. And that, of course, was the urban industrial core of the nation where two-thirds of Americans lived. So even though Bryan won all the rural, sparsely populated states of the South and West, McKinley and the Republicans solidified their grip on the urban industrial Northeast and upper Midwest, which had far more electoral votes. So that's how Republicans were able to hammer together a winning coalition that would persist for many years, broken only by Woodrow Wilson in 1912.
Come with hearts and voices, boys, we'll sing a brand new song. Sing it with a spirit that will thrill the mighty throng. Sing it till the millions hear and send the news along. While we go marching to victory. Hurrah, hurrah, McKinley is the man. Hurrah, hurrah, gold will lead the van. Then we will shout protection over all this glorious land. Marching with McKinley to victory.
Woodrow Wilson was the only Democratic president elected between 1896 and 1928. The boom economic period of the early 1920s saw the election of two consecutive Republican administrations under Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge. In 1928, the odds were very much against a Democratic upset.
By 1928, the nation was enjoying the biggest economic boom it ever had up to that time. And Republicans hogged all the credit. They insisted that everyone's job, everyone's paycheck was all thanks to them. They expected American voters to reward them at the ballot box for their largesse in helping the nation enjoy such prosperity and a soaring stock market in 1928. Well, we all know how that turned out the next year, but of course, people didn't know that at the time. So the fact that unemployment was very low, that factories were booming and business was growing, exports were booming, and the United States had become, you know, after the First World War, the industrial center of the world. These were developments of capitalism that the Republican Party claimed to be their own doing. And Herbert Hoover, the Republican candidate in 1928, had served throughout the decade as Secretary of Commerce in Republican administrations. So he particularly claimed credit for prosperity in that decade. And his campaign slogan, one of them in that election, was a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage, to remind Americans of the kind of material prosperity they've been enjoying under Republican leadership, and to, you know, suggest, as Republicans had been ever since 1896, that any reversion to Democratic rule would mean economic disaster and ruination.
Why then did the Democrats opt for an Irish-American Catholic opponent of prohibition and a supporter of New York's Tammany Hall machine as their candidate, Al Smith?
Yes, the Democratic Party had been riven throughout the 1920s by splits between its heavily urban, ethnic, immigrant-based wing in the North, heavily Catholic and Jewish, and its Southern wing, which was rural, very Protestant, and very prohibitionist. So these issues had divided the party severely in the decade, and the way they resolved it in 1928 was that the Southern rural Protestant dry prohibitionist faction gave up. They could see that whoever the party nominated never stood a chance in a year of great prosperity. So the urban ethnic industrial wing was allowed to nominate their champion. And he was a very strong candidate, Governor Al Smith of New York, the grandson of Irish immigrants and Italian immigrants too. He was grandson of both. He was Catholic and ethnic and urban as they could be. Sometime listen to him give a speech. There's that old time New York accent to the nth degree. You know, that guy talking on the radio must have sounded like a Martian to the folks out in Nebraska, you know, out in the countryside. He was very opposed to the Ku Klux Klan, which was kind of part and parcel of the Republican Party in the 1920s. And he was very opposed to prohibition. Al Smith was what in the 20s they called soaking wet, which means he hated the dry prohibitionists who were always trying to tell immigrants what to do with their with their cultures, you know, and to stop being so Catholic and so wet, going to saloons and keeping up their traditions. So Al Smith was the champion of the cities, the immigrants, the ethnic Americans, and those who were opposed to the Protestant meddling with their lifestyles.
And how much of a part did anti-Catholic prejudice play in the 1928 campaign?
It ended up playing a big part. Al Smith was the first Catholic nominee of any major party, and he faced a vicious campaign of bigotry waged by rural Protestants, Republicans, against him, especially in rural states. So there were conventions of Baptist ministers, there were whole Protestant sectarian newspapers that were created and published and disseminated widely that accused Al Smith of being a toady to Rome, of being a puppet of the Pope, of being like a secret agent of foreign potentate who, if he were elected to the White House, would bring in bishops and archbishops to make policy, who would close the public schools and subsidize Catholic schools with tax money, and of course plunge the nation back into the perdition of saloons and rum and drinking. So there was a terrible anti-Catholic tinge to the Republican campaign in 1928. Hoover himself did not get involved in that, but those campaigning on his behalf, it was a mainstay of their appeal.
Not to put too fine a point on it, the Democrats were absolutely hammered.
Yes, that was not a close election in 1928. Herbert Hoover, running on prosperity in a prosperous decade, got the kind of vote that Santa Claus would get on Christmas. He was widely credited with prosperity, and a lot of people wanted to keep it that way. So he got 58% of the popular vote, which was one of the all-time biggest popular vote majorities. I believe that was second ever up to that time, not counting elections like when George Washington ran unopposed, some of the weird ones in the early days. But of course, those records would later be broken, but it was a remarkable landslide in which the Republicans held on to their typical turf, in the upper Midwest and the urban Northeast, where factories and cities predominated, but they also made great inroads into the South and the West. They won most of the West, and or all of it. And this used to be Bryan's country. William Jennings Bryan in 1896 had called that his country. And whenever he crossed the Ohio or Mississippi River into the Northeast, he called that the enemy's country. So now, Hoover took back a lot of that turf. And the only states that went for Al Smith were in the Deep South, where they were never going to vote for a Republican because of Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War and those old issues.
It wasn't much consolation for Al Smith, but winning the election was about as good as it got for Hoover, because things went pear-shaped fairly quickly.
Well, you could say that. Hoover took office in 1929 saying the future of the nation is bright with hope, and even suggesting that stock prices were cheap at current prices as they were soaring to stratospheric heights in a gigantic bubble of speculation, such as to which capitalism is prone. And this was the greatest cyclical bubble of speculation yet. And of course, as everyone knows, it burst in October of 1929 in the Great Crash, when Wall Street, the stock market in New York, lost 40% of its value in a few days, and another 40% in the ensuing couple years. And companies across the land began laying off workers, and farm prices plummeted, wages plummeted. There was a terrible deflationary spiral, and all of it on Hoover's watch. So, a lot of Americans blamed Hoover for that, which was not entirely fair, but it was fair to blame him for his response to the onset of the Great Depression, which was to help banks and big corporations and railroad companies and insurance companies, but to do nothing to help the suffering victims of the Depression, the workers and farmers who faced literal starvation in the early 1930s. So that image of Hoover's hard-heartedness toward depression, privation, is what cemented onto the Republican Party for generations afterward the image of being against the working man and against the poor. And the Democrats were able to build a new majority coalition as the party of the have-nots, the party of the forgotten man, as their new champion, Franklin D. Roosevelt, would say.
Glenn Genzel on the 1928 presidential election.
East, west, north, south, oh say can you see? Al Smith is in his glory neath the presidential tree. Choice of all the people, everybody's old pal. Three big cheers for our leader, everybody loves our Al.
After the break, the controversial election of 1968. Welcome back to our special program on some of the nastiest presidential elections in American history. Fast forward almost four decades to 1964. Democratic Party President Lyndon Johnson is in the White House in the wake of the assassination of the first Catholic president of the USA, John F. Kennedy. In November 1964, LBJ was attempting to win a mandate of his own. His opponent was the conservative Republican Senator Barry Goldwater from Arizona. The uneven contest between the two men is described by Sandra Scanlon, lecturer in US history in University College Dublin.
So this is obviously very shortly after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in November 1963. And Lyndon Johnson, who had obviously become president after his assassination, was running against Barry Goldwater, who was an arch conservative. He was not the preferred choice for Republicans. Many Republicans had felt that he was too extreme, but he'd managed to win the nomination using the primary system, which we're all very familiar with today. But in 64, this was quite unusual to use that kind of system. So the kind of, you know, idea of backroom kind of politics where people are making decisions at the top was really the way that nominations were expected to run. So in many respects, Johnson was excited about the prospect of going against this quite unpopular in many respects figure. He was kind of the godfather of the conservative movement. So I think this campaign ultimately was more influential in growing conservatism. But at the time, there was a sense that this was really an opportunity for a landslide for Johnson. So there was no major challenge, obviously, to Johnson as the nominee, but there was a significant challenge to Goldwater. And the idea had really been that conservative activists had decided in 1960, and then again they'd built on this in 64, to really use this primary system. Most candidates didn't even enter the primaries. They didn't think it was relevant. But he managed to use this system to build up enough delegates that made it impossible for Republicans to challenge him when it came to that convention in 1964. They had tried, you know, so this was only about 6 to 8 weeks before the actual election. And they had, Republican leaders had said, including Nixon, let's try and get somebody else on the ballot. Let's try to turn those delegates against him. But it simply didn't happen. And he had the overwhelming support and became the Republican nominee.
So who were the other Republican contenders who might have beaten him and who might have done better against Lyndon Johnson?
Sure. So Nelson Rockefeller was one key person. He was, you know, governor of New York. He was a liberal Republican. That term nowadays seems, you know, oxymoronic in many respects. Richard Nixon, who had run in 1960 and had lost, obviously, to John F. Kennedy. He came in, you know, late in the day saying, well, you know, I'll take the nomination if necessary. But it simply wasn't possible, and Goldwater went on to become the nominee.
So what sort of campaign was fought between Johnson and Goldwater? I mean, are we talking about razzmatazz? Are we talking about advertising? Or was it a totally different time?
No, I think this was, in many respects, this was almost like a turning point for the way in which advertising and the kind of short commercials became so prominent. So we'd seen this in 1960 as well with the use of televised commercials. But a lot of those televised commercials, which were in Kennedy's favour, had really focused on sort of the glamour of the Kennedy family, images of his children and so forth. So they were kind of presenting this very positive image of Kennedy rather than really attacking Nixon in that context. In 1964, they took that idea, Democrats took that idea of using short campaigns that were really designed to be very emotional. So they're not looking to necessarily attack Goldwater on the basis of policy. It's much more just sort of attacking him in terms of stoking kind of fears. And this was most famously demonstrated in the Daisy commercial. This is really, in many respects, one of the most famous commercials in American political history.
One, two, three, four, five.
And what it showed was a little girl, she was 3 years old, picking petals off a daisy in a field. And she's counting down, you know, picking them off. 10, 9, 8.
8, 9.
10, 9, 8.
And then suddenly you hear this like mission control counting down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
1, 0.
And then the image in the background is of a mushroom cloud.
These are the stakes. To make a world in which all of God's children can live. Or to go into the dark. We must either love each other or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
The idea being that this is, if you elect Goldwater, it's going to be World War III. The idea that he's so conservative, he's such a strong cold warrior, that he is essentially a maniac, that he is a warmonger, he's trigger happy, he's going to create World War III, as I said. So in many respects, that kind of campaigning was more about appealing to the kind of fears that people had about Goldwater rather than trying to attack him on specific policies. Now, there were attacks on his policies, but I think this is what's most memorable about that campaign.
So at the end of the day, how badly mauled was Barry Goldwater?
So this was one of those, definitions of a landslide. He was senator from Arizona, so he took his home state. He also crucially took five states in the Deep South that had traditionally been really going right back to the Civil War, had been Democratic strongholds. So in many respects, this is a turning point for the conservative movement in the sense that Republicans were starting to gain traction in the South. Now, the reason, of course, that he had won those Deep South states was because he had famously objected. He had voted against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You really see in a lot of his own campaigning, actually, that kind of appeal to law and order, where he talks about kind of the dangers, of petty crime and the dangers that are coming from Democrats, lax attitude to law and order. And everybody knew that there's a certain race baiting going on there. So I think as much as Goldwater may have talked about the idea that he wasn't, he wasn't personally racist, there's certainly a lot of evidence that his campaign in appealing to the South really was using those kind of racist tropes. But no, this was very much understood as a landslide victory for Johnson.
Four years later, and the American political landscape had changed radically. By 1968, the Vietnam War, which was just beginning to heat up when LBJ ran against Goldwater, had intensified and was costing thousands of young American lives and hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese lives. An anti-war movement was determined to oppose the incumbent president for the Democratic Party nomination. Its standard bearer was Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy.
Gene McCarthy was a very important player. I mean, he was not the first leader nor the last, but at a critical moment, he voiced that opposition in a brilliant way. I mean, it was real opposition and it was very well stated intellectually. The good thing about Gene McCarthy was he didn't put one foot forward and one foot backward. I mean, he really took on the president and he really took on the war.
The late David Halberstam, one of the most distinguished American journalists of the Vietnam generation, speaking to me in 1988 for a documentary program on the 1968 election. I also spoke to Eugene McCarthy 20 years after his failed attempt to secure the Democratic Party nomination. It began with unexpected success in one of the few party primaries which were actually staged back in the 1960s in the state of New Hampshire. A concerted campaign, fronted mainly by young student volunteers, produced an unexpected result, with McCarthy getting almost half the votes in a contest with an incumbent president. Johnson had spurned the New Hampshire primary, and when it became apparent that McCarthy's insurgent campaign was gaining ground, the president was reliant on that rather odd American practice of writing in the name of a candidate who was not on the ballot paper.
In New Hampshire, generally in early primaries here, if you can beat the estimates of the experts, you don't have to win. Well, part of it was there for the taking, I think. There was some general unpopularity of Johnson, which was almost certain, we thought, to get us the 12% we'd get. I thought that I might, as a candidate, appeal to another 12%. We thought we could get 25 or 30%, and we in effect got 50%. A number of things happened after the commitment. We also suggested on the side that what they hadn't taken into account was that New Hampshire at that time had the highest rate of alcoholism and the highest percentage of people over 65 in the polling places were very cold, so just the trembling vote would give us some votes. You add all those things together, why it was enough to make the 42%.
You know, the New Hampshire primaries are unique in politics. They're the only races where anybody can run. And everybody can win.
Johnson's dismissive ebullience didn't last. On March 31st, he stunned the nation with this announcement.
With America's future under challenge right here at home, with our hopes and the world's hopes for peace and the balance every day, I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
With Johnson out of the race, the contest was now wide open. Vice President Hubert Humphrey announced his intention to run, as did Robert Kennedy, the latter pledging to end the war. Back in 1988, I spoke to Kennedy's then press secretary, Frank Mankiewicz, about what appeared to many to be an opportunistic move by the former Attorney General that threatened to split the anti-war vote.
I would say that he jumped in not when he saw how well McCarthy had done, because nobody thought McCarthy was going anywhere, at least of all McCarthy, I think, but how badly Johnson had done, because it became clear to him that he need have no fear of dividing the party. The party was already clearly divided and hostile to Johnson. And actually, I think if he had stayed out of the race, Johnson would have beaten McCarthy. He beat him in New Hampshire. I mean, people forget that. Lyndon Johnson was a write-in candidate in New Hampshire, and he beat McCarthy, but he didn't beat him by enough. I think Johnson would have prevailed against McCarthy alone, but it would have been very divisive.
Well, I was disturbed by, especially since he had told me he wouldn't. I mean, that's always a little bit disturbing. But I wasn't going to run if he was going to run. I said, you know, if it's anti-Johnson, you can't have divided forces. And so when he came in, were two things. One, that the anti-war people would be divided, but also we anticipated he would be offering a watered-down compromise position, which is what he did. And it was finally reflected in what he said in the joint appearance in California when he charged that I was prepared to negotiate with communists. He said, well, who else, you know? He, in effect, said he wouldn't negotiate. He would just lay down terms, sort of, we will stop bombing if you stop supplying your troops. It's sort of like saying, we'll stop eating for 3 days if you stop breathing for 2 hours.
As Kennedy and McCarthy competed for the anti-war vote in those states that were staging primaries, Vice President Humphrey adopted a more old-school approach in dealing mainly with state party bosses who controlled the delegations to the Democratic Party selection convention due to take place in Chicago that year. A few weeks before the convention, Kennedy won the crucial California primary. The victory speech he made in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles afterwards was to be his last.
So I thank all of you. The oath of you are here. My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
Well, I was walking right behind him. I was walking with Ethel, in fact, trying to catch up. You know, he didn't have any bodyguards. When he jumped down off the stage, because that guy from the hotel wanted to take him through the kitchen, we stayed behind to help Ethel down, and then I was trying to catch up with him when I heard the shots.
They've got the gun. I can't see the man. I can't see who it is. But Senator Kennedy right now is on the ground. He has been shot. Hold him, Raper. We don't want another Oswald. There's a certain amount of fanaticism here now. I can only say that here in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel, the senator walked out the back. I was directly behind him. You heard a balloon go off and a shot. You didn't really realize that the shot was a shot. And yet, a scream went up. Two men were on the ground, both bleeding profusely. One of them was Senator Robert Kennedy.
Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not?
A young Senator Edward Kennedy delivering his brother's eulogy. With the race now down in effect to two contenders, the insurgent McCarthy and the establishment figure Humphrey, it was all down to who had the numbers to win in Chicago.
I don't know what they expected. See, the primaries were over, even though we did win the New York primary after that, but it didn't really mean anything because you were running against Bobby and that was gone. And the campaign that we would have had mounted against Johnson and so on was too late. The non-primary states, I think, all had chosen their delegates by that time. So all you could do is what we did do. Well, we held public rallies and so on. But the only other thing you do is go to the delegations in the non-primary states, which were already chosen, and try to persuade them that they ought to be for me instead of for Humphrey. But practically all of them had been chosen as pro-Johnson, regular party people. There wasn't much you could do. We went to, I think, 15 or 20 states and talked to people, and they didn't get any more attention.
The 1968 Democratic Party convention is seen justifiably as one of the most chaotic in American history. Within the walls of the convention center itself, there was division, anger, and mayhem. In the streets of Chicago, there was near anarchy, as the police force of Major Richard Daley and thousands of anti-war protesters came to grips in what was later described as a police riot. Ike Pappas was a CBS News correspondent who'd been told by his station to move to Chicago a few months before the convention in order to gain some insights into the mood of the city.
And I remember attending the first press conference with Richard J. Daley, and I walked in and sat down and I let the other reporters go, the local reporters, as is customary. When you're a visitor, you let them get their questions out of the way. And then when the news conference had reached its peak as far as they're concerned, and I had time, I asked my question, and I said something about, are you going to expect trouble during the convention? And Daley looked at me, and he said, where are you from? I said, I live in this city. He said, no, you're not. He said, you're from New York City. He said, and we're not taking any questions from out-of-towners.
There's no dictation in the Democratic Party. There's never been any dictation. I've been the chairman of two conventions, one in 19 caucuses, in 60 and 64, and the men that are in this room know that every delegate was permitted to get up in the caucus, speak the way he wanted, and vote the way he wanted.
Covering the convention for the New York Times was former Vietnam correspondent David Halberstam.
Well, I was there in Chicago, and I mean, it was all the things that had been pulling apart in American society suddenly came together in that city and at that convention. I mean, all the different forces, and I mean, it was like the visible symbol of the iceberg of the society of different, I mean, you know, that the old order, the old political order, which was symbolized by Johnson and Mayor Daley, was just coming apart. That the for a variety of reasons, but the war certainly more than anything else. I mean, there were all sorts of people who wanted to be involved in the political process, and the political process, as it had been then established, did not have place for them. And now, because of the war, they wanted in anyway, and they doubly wanted in because of the war. And the real convention was not on the floor, the convention was in the streets. And it was a very tough, raw kind of confrontation between, in effect, the people of the streets and the Daley machine.
Well, Humphrey had a majority of the delegates, and so they won all the votes. And they intended to do that and forced it through. It was fairly ugly.
Sergeant-at-Arms, enforce order in the convention. The question is on the motion. So many as in favor will vote aye.
Aye!
Those opposed, no. The ayes have it.
I think we challenged something like 20 delegations as being either illegal or one or two as being unconstitutional, and whatever grounds we used, they differed from state to state. We had cases like this. I think I got two votes from the whole Michigan delegation. and by every measure, about half of the Michigan Democrats were for me or against the war, but the delegates had been chosen 2 years before when the issue hadn't been raised, and they were all party regulars. So instead of giving us roughly 50% of the delegates that we deserved, we got 2 out of, I think, 80.
And I truly believe that history will surely record the greatness of his contribution to the people of this land. And tonight to you, Mr. President, I say thank you. Thank you, Mr. President.
I remember working that corridor as the demonstrations were going on, the aisle that led to the Mayor Daley's section of the Illinois delegation. And Daley was screaming at the speakers, like Rubikoff, who were saying that there were problems in the streets, and the streets of the city are out of control, and people should be given a chance to express themselves. And Daley screamed at him and cursed him. There was that kind of brutality that was going on. And physically, we were being pushed by his goons, you know, away from him, up the aisle, and they physically threw us out of the area. Again, you know, where is access? Where is the public's right to know? So there was that kind of brutality that was going on.
So I was up there with Rubikoff. He asked me whether I thought he ought to speak extemporaneously and throw away his prepared text, and I said, oh, by all means. So we talked about it. So I was not surprised to see him give that speech, but I couldn't see what was going on in the hall while he was speaking, because I was the next speaker.
Is there any rule under which Mayor Daley can be compelled to suspend the police state terror perpetrated this minute on kids in front of the Conrad Hilton?
Mr. Chairman.
The chair must announce that we are calling the roll of the states, and we recognize delegates for no other purpose than to answer the call.
They fired tear gas at him. They crippled a few.
Police just grabbed somebody, are beating him over the head, and are trying to throw him into the paddy wagon.
But it always, not so much were the physical bruises, but the bruises to what the United States is and stood for and stands for, which is, you know, equality and democracy and the person's right to redress and to protest and to assemble in protest. And all of that was denied them.
A lot of it was class. I mean, the cops were sort of these, you know, raw blue-collar kids who probably had brothers in Vietnam, and they looked at the protesters, and they were upper, to their minds, upper class, who were protesting the war and everything else and weren't good Americans. I mean, it was probably more raw than anything else with class. It was really a conflict of cultures and class, and it was very raw. And the cops must have been scared. I mean, where was in their mind the America they knew? Loyalty, fight a war, salute the flag, go to church. You know, I mean, maybe drink a little bit too much on Friday night or something like that, but where was the America they knew and loved? Who were these goddamn people who were, you know, singing peace, not war, and sex in the streets? I mean, flower, I mean, it was another America they didn't understand and was challenging them and seemed to be winning.
Here they come. They're charging into it. They're just swinging into this crowd. They're pushing the crowd. It's a stampede.
There goes a big blast of tear gas. I can't see. He got me in the face. Oh, man.
Thursday night was the night that they broke into the hotel rooms and arrested people and took them out of their beds. And this was after Humphrey had been nominated. And they charged them with all sorts of things, you know, throwing ashtrays at the police and excrement and so on. And most of the people that they rounded up, they had to get out of bed. And they never proved any of their charges, but this was the public charge made by the police. Never one of them pursued. They released, they didn't even take them to jail. They just tore them out of their beds and made the public statement that these things were going on. As I went down, when I heard what had happened, and there was a kind of a lobby on each floor in the Hilton, and our floor was the 15th, and I got off on the 15th floor, and there were tables and things were all tipped over into shambles. And there was a young woman crying, and she said, we were just playing bridge. She said, I had a 21-point hand. So they broke up the bridge game. I mean, this is how violent these people were. And then the Secret Service, whom I had, were reliable people, and I was going to leave town on Friday. And they said, don't leave town on Friday, because the minute you leave, the Chicago police, and they're going to arrest everybody with a McCarthy identification and charge them with disturbing the peace and other charges. So it was a deliberate plan to try to discredit the people who had been protesting, who had been marching. So I stayed, and we put the word out for everybody to, you know, get out of town on Friday or Saturday morning, or at least get to the airport, which was federal jurisdiction. You'd be beyond the reach of Mayor Daley.
Despite the divisive convention and the nature of his selection from a long way back in the polls, the eventual Democratic nominee, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, ran a capable campaign against the Republican nominee, former Vice President Richard Nixon. His cause was helped when he stepped away from Johnson and announced his opposition to the continuation of U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War.
Nixon was terribly unpopular, as always. And Humphrey began to turn it around when he came out against the war. You know, from that moment on, that speech in, where was it, Salt Lake City. From then on, he gained on Nixon. Also, George Wallace was in that race and got about 13% of the vote, and I think most of that would have gone to Nixon. That was part of the pro-war vote that was split away. But Humphrey ran a good campaign after the convention.
But it was not enough to beat the Republicans. Nixon went on to win a second term in 1972 before being forced to resign when he became engulfed in the Watergate scandal. However, between 1968 and 1988, the Democrats only managed a single term in the White House, that of the ill-fated Jimmy Carter. The 1980s belonged to Ronald Reagan, the affable conservative with the consummate communication skills. In 1988, however, the 22nd Amendment obliged him to step down. Eager to take his place was his vice president, George Herbert Walker Bush. Equally enthusiastic was Bush's Democratic opponent, the governor of Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis. As Sandra Scanlon attests, while the candidates themselves were relatively civilized, the supporting cast of aides, advisors, public relations operatives and campaign managers was anything but.
There was a lot more division in the Democratic Party about who was going to get that nomination, and that was a really nasty nominating fight.
So who did Dukakis face up against in 88, in the Democratic primary?
So the expectation was that Senator Gary Hart was going to be the nominee. He was extremely popular. He was quite liberal, but also, you know, had this kind of post New Deal, post-Great Society attitude. He was seen as a very modern figure. He was ultimately taken down by evidence of adultery, not something that would be a major problem nowadays. But at the time, this was enough to essentially ruin his campaign. Joe Biden, with whom we're all familiar, I'm sure, at this stage, Joe Biden was also one of the contenders. He ended up losing, or withdrawing rather, from the nominating contest because Michael Dukakis, who went on to win, his team leaked a tape of Biden practicing a speech that Neil Kinnock, the British Labour Party leader, had delivered. And that's, you know, with only minor changes. So they leaked this tape and then accused him of plagiarism. And again, this wouldn't happen today, but that was enough at the time for Joe Biden to feel that he had to withdraw from the race as well. So ultimately, Michael Dukakis went on to win it. But what was probably most significant in terms of the opposition was that Jesse Jackson, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who was the first African-American man to really go forward for the Democratic nomination, he succeeded in winning several primaries. He didn't get the nomination. He didn't have the number of delegates required at the end of the day, but it really was a very significant challenge to Dukakis and a sign that African Americans were at this point, as they had been for many years, but really pushing for a more significant voice within the Democratic Party.
Now, Dukakis began the presidential election campaign with a polling advantage against George Herbert Walker Bush, but that quickly evaporated. Why was that?
So in some respects, I think this is the election where you really see that kind of politics of fear becoming really, really prominent at a national level. We'd seen that again, as I mentioned, in 1964. But what happened here was essentially there was a mood for change. Dukakis, as you say, had a polling lead. But what Republicans were very effective at doing was saying, well, do you really want to take that risk? Do you really want to take a chance on liberals who, thinking back to Carter, thinking back to Johnson, had been, you know, the idea was that these are ineffective at managing the country. perhaps most importantly, well, first of all, I would say that the Dukakis campaign didn't do a great job. So they, in many respects, lost this themselves. But one of the most significant changes in advertising about this was the so-called Willie Horton or revolving door advertising that Republicans utilized. So this, again, is one of the most famous commercials in American political history. It started out with a commercial that was put forward by not the Bush campaign itself, but was put forward by supporters of Bush. And that specifically referenced a man named Willie Horton, a black man who was imprisoned in 1975 in Massachusetts. And under a furlough scheme that was put in place before Dukakis became governor, he was released, as were, you know, many individuals who were not eligible for parole. They were released on these very short furlough passes to visit family. He, like some others, did abscond. He went on to commit a crime. He kidnapped a couple in Maryland, attacked the man, raped the woman. So this was obviously highly significant. And this ad was then utilized to really represent this idea that Dukakis was soft on crime, that, you know, he was somehow responsible for this having happened. But the way in which, you know, Willie Horton was represented, and in many ways it was mostly about creating this idea that, you know, this racialized notion of black men as dangerous and as liberals, the so-called Massachusetts liberal that was Dukakis, was simply too soft on crime.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
So there was an uproar in response to this advertisement. But the Bush campaign's response was not to say, look, this had nothing to do with us. We didn't actually put this out. In fact, they created a new advertisement that didn't specifically reference Horton, but did talk about Dukakis having this so-called revolving door with criminals just being allowed in and out of prison. And the whole idea was, you know, that these are people are soft on crime. And the tagline of that commercial was, America can't afford that risk. So the idea here was really that in electing Dukakis, electing a liberal, electing Democrats, you're taking a risk. But again, most of this was about appealing to fear, appealing to Americans, you know, ideas about race and racial division. And in many ways, this certainly exacerbated and doubled down on the kind of racialized politics that we're so familiar with now.
And Bush, to some extent, was able to remain above all this, but his attack dog was a man called Lee Atwater. And I mean, Lee Atwater, he wasn't the first, but, you know, in terms of the modern era, he was the first of many attack dogs that we have subsequently seen, wasn't he?
Absolutely. And he worked closely with a later president, George W. Bush. He was, of course, George H.W. Bush's son. And, you know, before there was an expectation that George W. Bush would go on to the presidency, he was sort of put out there as George H.W. Bush's attack dog, that he can say things that the president can't say, or the person going for president rather wants to appear presidential. And Lee Atwater was an interesting kind of character in the sense that he had a kind of a turnaround later in life, and he was very open about, you know, how explicit and intentional this kind of racialized politics was. So he famously, you know, said later on, he said, you know, we realized you can't use the N-word. You can't talk about that kind of politics. You can't be that explicit.
But you can use the dog whistle.
You can use the dog whistle. So this kind of notion of an almost like colorblind attitude to these issues of law and order, when everybody knew that when you talked about law and order, as Nixon did in 1968, and others did as well, as Reagan did when he ran for, you know, in 1980, using this kind of language, the language of states' rights, everybody knew this is a dog whistle for talking about racial division. It's a dog whistle to appeal to white supremacists. And people like George H.W. Bush may have liked the idea that, you know, they were colorblind, that they were not involved in these politics, but they knew that their vote depended on this kind of white nationalist, white supremacist mentality. And it took until Trump before, in many ways, Republicans had to own up to the realities that they depended on this vote. But certainly in 1988, you really saw very, very clear evidence that Republicans were deliberately using this kind of racialized politics to stir up this sort of fear in the electorate.
And it worked. The election did not go well for Dukakis.
No, this was in lots of ways. You know, you think back to Johnson being a landslide. This was in many ways the last landslide that we've seen. It was the last time that a president won over 400 electoral college votes. So it really was, in some respects, the political mood changed in the 1990s in that the country became in many respects even more divided. But yeah, this was a landslide for Bush.
Dr. Sandra Scanlon on the 1988 US presidential election. That's it from the History Show this week. My thanks to Mark McGrath on sound and to our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE Radio. From producer Lorcan Clancy and from me, Miles Dungan, goodbye and thanks for listening.